Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of the Marketplace Discussions podcast. My name is Mahmoud Resmi, and today's guest is Gregory Sadler. After a career as a fairly traditional academic, teaching and publishing in philosophy, religious studies, and critical thinking, Gregory decided to transition into the entrepreneurial world, providing public and client-focused work. He is the founder of Reason.io, a company that provides philosophical counseling services, as well as executive coaching and ethics consulting. In addition, Gregory has a popular YouTube channel with 135,000 subscribers and over 2,500 videos. I hope you enjoy today's discussion. If you have any questions, feel free to leave them in the comments section below if you're on YouTube, or to reach out to me at decafquest on Twitter. If you enjoyed the episode, please click on the subscribe button, and thank you very much for listening.
I'm on Central Time because I'm in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Okay.
So just north of Chicago, about an hour and a half. And right now it's 10:03, so still morning time for me.
Yeah. It's 5 p.m. here in Spain, Salamanca, and I think it's 11 Eastern. And
yeah,
you're starting
right.
An Aristotle course tomorrow.
Yeah, it starts tomorrow this time, my time. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. How, let's start maybe with introducing who you are and what you do, because I jumped right into the Aristotle course. So first off, Gregory, thank you very much for joining me today on the Marketplace Discussions podcast. I am a huge fan. I came across your videos way back, and I actually forgot the year because I was a master's student in 2012. I did not major in philosophy. I only minored, graduated 2010. I think you joined YouTube right around that time, maybe.
2011, yeah.
So I came across your work. I did 1 year of a gap year in Salamanca where I studied Spanish, and then I did my master's 2011-2012, and that was, I think, where your courses started kind of being helpful, or your videos, basically. You were recording videos of your philosophy courses and uploading them on YouTube. So it's really good to have you here today, because I was watching your videos X years ago, and then for my PhD, and then all of a sudden we're having a discussion here. So that's always nice. So you're a philosophy professor. Tell us about yourself a bit.
Well, I can list myself, I suppose, formally as a philosophy professor, because I have a weird rank at Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design, which is adjunct full professor. So an adjunct is somebody who's not full-time, right? It's somebody who gets hired sometimes only semester to semester. At my ad, fortunately, we have, you know, expectation of getting hired back each term. But they have ranks that go from adjunct lecturer to adjunct assistant professor all the way to full. And when I get hired, I had so many years of teaching that they just put me in there at the highest level. So I'm kind of a professor, but kind of not. I've been a professor before full-time at other places. And, you know, when you're mentioning those videos, I was working as an adjunct as well at Marist College. So I do that. And then it's going more than 10 years back. I've got my own business. And so I produce, you know, you mentioned the videos, there's podcast episodes, writing, I work with clients, sometimes just, you know, regular people who want to do philosophical counseling and work on their issues or tutorials, but all the way up to like doing executive coaching with CEOs and other C-suite people. And then I do, you know, a good bit of public speaking, and I'm sure I'm leaving something. Oh, I offer online courses. And so I keep pretty busy, you know. So there's the, we could call it the old school professional philosophy side. And then there's the more 21st century innovative kind of business oriented side, although I have to admit I'm terrible at marketing.
So. I'm not so sure about terrible at marketing, but you're definitely a pioneer in the domain. You've been posting YouTube videos, like you've gone all digital, I think, way before anyone else. Like maybe others have been doing it, but then it's like to choose around 2010-11 to start uploading your lectures on YouTube. That is innovative in and of itself. Before we get into the philosophy consulting business, which I'm also interested in, but how did you end up doing that?
So there is a story there that will make you think I'm not quite so innovative and progressive. My wife was the one who talked me into it when she wasn't my wife, but just my fiance. She is very into, you know, developing technologies. And back then she was actually an assistant dean of educational technology at the Culinary Institute of America. And she had bought me a flip cam, you know, one of those little tiny, and they were actually called Flip. There was a company called Flip before they went out of business. And she bought me one for sort of chronicling my trips with my kids. I'd recently gotten divorced. And so we had, you know, summer vacation. And then she said, you know, you could actually record lectures in your classes. This is kind of a new thing that people are doing. It's called lecture capture. And I was like, I guess I could do that. You know, it seems like a little bit of extra work. And then I thought about it and I was like, well, I do have a lot of students who miss classes and it would be nice for them to be able to go back to it. So she talked me into doing it. And then she was like, put them on YouTube. And I was like, who the hell's going to watch me? I'm a nobody, you know? And so I did that with the university that I was at the time called Fayetteville State University. And those were these critical thinking lectures, which I don't actually own. They own those because at that time, you may remember this, YouTube would only allow you to upload like 10 minutes at a time and then 15 minutes and then 20 minutes. But if you had an institutional account, you could upload entire class sessions. So they have all of those. And then when I moved up to New York to be with my fiance, now wife, Andy, and I started recording at Marist, I asked them, hey, can I record lectures? And they were like, do what? And I said, you know, like put a video camera down in class and just record what I'm doing and saying. And they're like, oh, I don't know about that. And I was like, it's good for the students. You know, they can go back to it over time. And again, I had no idea that a lot of other people would be watching it. But as it turned out, in part because there weren't many people doing it, you know, a lot of people would watch the lectures and then say, you know, it was interesting, some of the comments. The worst comments in one respect were people saying, my professor won't explain anything. So thanks for explaining, you know, Aristotle's metaphysics or Descartes, you know, meditations, because otherwise I was going to flunk my class. That's terrible, right? So, and then there were others who were saying things like, you know, I can't afford to go to college, or I've been out of college for a while. It's nice to watch these lectures because it's like being in college again. And then there were other people who were, I think, like in your case, using them to, you know, supplement what they were studying already. Right. So it just kind of grew. And, you know, when you get good feedback from people, it makes it easier to keep on doing something. I think if everyone had like weighed in and been like, Sadler, you suck, you know, maybe I wouldn't have kept up with it.
But yeah, I don't know if you were receiving, maybe because the comments you mentioned, I mean, on the one hand, they might be bad because of their experiences at their universities. But then, did you receive any kind of hater comments on YouTube?
Oh,
and the reason why I'm asking that is I'm comparing it to what would things have been if you were maybe posting them also on Twitter nowadays, right? With all the trolling.
Yeah, that's
and
a
hate
good
comments.
Example.
How was it, like the hate?
Yeah, you would get occasional things that are just totally unconnected to what you're saying. And you know, they're basically amounting to, I hate you, you suck, go away. And so I just delete those and then block those people, because I look at my social media and my YouTube channel as sort of like being my front porch. You can hang out there, but if you're not civil, then I kick you out, because it's my place, so I don't have to put up with that. And then, you know, I mean, we could actually do like an entire episode about the goofy comments that you get, and you probably get quite a few of these too, especially on Twitter, and because you like to poke the philosophy people. So you get a lot of people who think that they're going to correct you about what you've got wrong about Nietzsche or Kant or pick whoever else, and it's usually almost always they've got something wrong, but they're totally convinced that you're the one who's got it wrong. So they'll write a really long rant about this or that. And, you know, I in the past, I used to try to engage those people, but then I realized pretty quickly they're not good faith interlocutors. So I just delete and block. And then, you know, I've had quite a few ideological things. It's interesting, in the early Trump years here in America, racists began feeling quite emboldened. And because I have a family last name that happens to be Jewish, even though it's not my family's original name, on my father's side, the original name was Skufka, because my grandfather was Slovenian, but he changed it to Sadler because he wanted to get ahead in business here in the United States. And being a Slav at that time was, you know, going to be a problem. So I'd have people weighing in and saying, look at his Jewish face. You know, you can tell right off the bat with his nose or things like that. And, you know, you'd get weird crap like that. And, you know, I think there's probably a whole bunch of other, we could classify the other weird things that people say. I do get a lot of people. So I created some videos that are like frequently asked questions videos, because I was getting so many comments of certain sorts, like people ask me something that they should just go to Google for, you know? And so I created a video about that. Just do a search. Or I have people who are clearly trying to, especially around this time of the year, use my channel to get me to do their homework for them or give them answers to test questions. So I created a video for that. Or I get a lot of people giving me advice about what video content I should produce next. And so I say, well, it's nice that you're interested in the channel, but if you want me to stop doing what I'm doing and do your thing, you can pay me to do that. You can commission a video. And I actually, to be fair, I've had a few people who have put their money where their mouth is on Heidegger and Nietzsche stuff. It's funny because the most requested thing is Spinoza. Won't you do some videos on Spinoza? And I'll be like, sure, yeah, if you want me to stop, you know, my schedule and like shift it to do your thing, go ahead and hire me and I'll do it. Nobody ever wants to put up the money for it.
Yeah, and this is in fact interesting. I mean, you're solving problems in a philosophical kind of way. These videos are definitely, you're basically trolling people as well. Like they're trolling you. You troll them with more videos.
You're talking about on my Twitter, right?
Yeah. Twitter and, you know, do a Google search video. I mean, that's,
oh right, yeah,
not the actual philosophical content, but the philosophy also in terms of maybe not necessarily hate, but the pushback that you might get. Have you ever been told, going back to the people who were trying to correct you or who would correct you, maybe also about your teaching style? Did you have comments about that? Because,
oh yeah, yeah,
you like to make your at least your college university courses highly interactive. You try to kind of make the material relatable to the students, and this is where I was also inspired by you, because I was using the videos for my courses when I was teaching, and so it's always been inspiring to me, because it's like, this is the kind of philosophy I want to be doing, right? So have you gotten any pushback on that? I'm curious.
You know, the pushback that I've gotten has mainly been people, and it's kind of rare, but they'll say, oh, this is too simple. You know, this is this is at a beginner level. And I'll say, well, these are beginner classes, you know, intro to philosophy, ethics for non-majors. And I think there's a kind of, there's an elitism there that's not really based. Some elitisms can be based in something where you genuinely deserve to be in an elite and then, you know, make judgments. But I think when it comes to a lot of academic matters, the elitism is kind of hollow. And it's more about feeling like you're in a, you know, a class of intelligentsia or intellectuals, and everybody else is kind of, you know, wasting your time. And I don't look at doing philosophy that way. And I'm assuming that you don't either, going by all the things I've seen you say, that, you know, it's something that we should be willing to share widely. And if the philosophy, when we're teaching it, can't connect with non-philosophers, students who could be in business or fashion design or nursing, then that's our problem. You know, we have to be the ambassadors for the discipline. And I do like to make, you're right, I like the lectures to be really interactive. It's boring when just to get up and lecture, you know. I mean, I guess you could say that a lot of my videos that are not in classrooms are me doing just that. But I try to think, as I'm looking at the camera in my room all by myself, what would somebody who hasn't read this text and is interested in this, how would I reach them, you know? And I think that's not the only possible take you could take in philosophy, but I think that's maybe one of the most productive. And I remember being a student and sitting in classes and being bored out of my mind at some lecturer, usually some old guy, just droning on and on, right? Or at conferences, hearing the same kind of thing.
Are the worst as well, because you'd expect, like, maybe a course, if you know, yeah, the professor has been there for 30, 50 years, you'd be like, okay, fine. I mean, he's doing his thing. But at conferences, yeah, it's like you're there to kind of communicate what you're,
exactly,
or your findings or what you're writing about, and then it becomes just boring and
get people interested and of course asking questions that are kind of from left field. If you don't mind me going off on a tangent, I'll tell you about
sure.
So I had a colleague, and he was a pretty cool guy. He was a bit older than me, an English guy, and we would go to conferences together. This is when I was at Fayetteville State University. He was also in the philosophy department. And there was money for going to conferences. So we would, like, you know, sign up and go, you know, to this Neoplatonist conference. And the first couple times that I saw him talking about stuff, it was really engaging. He was somebody who was also an actor, like, you know, doing local theater performance. So he was really good. But then it turned me off when I saw him basically telling the same stories in the same way at the same times in his presentation, because the first couple times you feel like it's genuine and not rehearsed, and it's revealing something of this person and their love for the topic or something like that. But after you've heard it like three or four times, you're like, oh, this is just a shtick. This is canned, you know? And it completely ruined the ethos of that for me. I mean, I still liked him as a person, but there was always that sense of something having been lost, you know.
How do you, I completely kind of agree with you, and that, yeah, it does turn me off when it comes to just, you know, recounting the same stories. And I've thought about this quite a lot, especially with regard to people who are like, you know, the famous people who go on talks
right
here and there, right? And then they maybe are at a certain point where they don't have enough time to come up with new stories, so they cannot research.
Yeah.
So this is at least the justification I would give as to why they repeat the same stories. But how would you combat that? How do you combat that? Because I've also been struggling myself. It's like, how can I just approach things the same thing, but differently, because we're teaching the same courses, we're teaching, yeah, you know.
I mean, I do sometimes tell the same story, but I don't tell it in the same way. And that's maybe one way around it. I'm not using rehearsed language. And you're right. If you are like, if you've made it big, you probably don't have enough time to develop a lot of new stuff. And you're probably going to get a little stale because you're not getting enough time to keep on reading. The other thing I've got working for me is that if you have a wide range of matters that you're engaging with, you're probably not going to have the chance to get stale like that, you know. So I used to teach a lot of classes for a lot of different institutions, and then I'd also shoot videos and, you know, do other speaking things. And so I would just keep making up new stuff. I mean, making up is probably the wrong word, because really what I'm doing most of the time is I'm taking somebody else's ideas and then presenting them in a way that's accessible. I'm not coming up with any radical new theories or concepts or approaches of my own. You know, every once in a while I'll coin a phrase like ontological dignity and talking about Anselm, but usually those don't catch on. So I don't have
you
to
never
worry
know
about that.
When you'd get lucky and it
that's true, yeah. Yeah. And that's it. It's completely luck, you know. So much of this is just a matter of like being in the right place at the right time, I would say.
Tell me.
Well, I was going to say there's an interesting analogy as you were bringing up the big names that do that sort of thing. I was thinking about like in terms of bands. So if you're a great band, you've probably been playing for a long time, coming up in clubs and things like that. So you've perfected, you've got your cover tunes that you've been doing, and then you've got your original material. And then suddenly you get your first album out and people are like, holy shit, this is amazing. I'm going to go see them. Let me get a t-shirt, you know, and they tell all their friends about it. And then the real challenge is, your second record, because generally you've only got, you know, 6 months to actually produce it, and you're on tour and you've already used up your good song ideas. So you've got to come up with some new song ideas, right? You can't just keep doing the same old thing. And if your new record is too much like the first record, then people are going to be like, they don't really, they don't have much range. I mean, unless you're AC/DC or somebody like that. But if it's too different, then they're like, yeah, this is not the same band anymore. And then, you know, once you get going and you get to like your seventh, eighth album, and now like you're a big thing, like say Iron Maiden, right? And you're on tour all over the place all the time. There's a tendency to just go back to the hits. And actually, I have a friend who he's the guy that I used to do the classic metal class with, and we're hoping to start resuming it again, Scott Cerulli. He's a guitar professor and practicing musician. And so he goes to a lot more gigs, and he hates it when he walks in and he sees the bands just playing the old hits from the 70s and 80s, right? Rather than like supporting their new album. And he calls them out publicly on Facebook about that sometimes. And I think he's right, you know, but there is this tendency to like stick to what, you know, the audience is going to like, rather than confront them with something radically new. Now, certain bands can get away with that much more easily. Like if you're Tool, you know, people come to your stuff and they expect that the next album is going to be different than the last one. But if you're, I mean, to take the other extreme, if AC/DC were to produce an album where suddenly they go progressive, everyone would be like, what the hell is this crap?
So. Yeah. And I don't know if this is also similar to maybe stand-up comedians, but I and this new
oh yeah
material,
yeah
and in praise of the process, because I did write curiously an article about this 4 or 5 weeks ago, or no, maybe 2 months ago, yeah, or something, whatever, or like not so long ago, and it was about this in praise of the process, and I was comparing it to my stuff as well, like my classes.
Yeah.
So if I am And comparing it with university professors who also stick to the same thing and they just regurgitate it,
yeah,
without coming up with new material. And I was trying to think about the reasons why this happens. Like in my case, I'm teaching online courses, so my margin of error here is like I cannot just present or launch a course and then try to come up with new material on the go or try out new material like the comedians do with stand-up comedy. They go to comedy clubs, they have new jokes they're working with, they're trying to come up with new material, so they test it out there. In my case now, online, I don't really have that because I don't put lectures online or anything of the sort, so it's just the courses. At university, it's kind of similar because eventually the professors are overwhelmed with research and service work, etc. So is it something similar? Have you gone through that? And how, so I was just thinking, you know, how can professors and educators in general kind of establish something common as the comedians have to test out new materials? Right, I don't know, like something along the lines. Now, I don't know if bands do, like they might not end up going to clubs to play new material, but it's curious, no? Like there is no space where people would know that they would join you, just like the comedy clubs, right?
Yeah.
Knowing that you're working out new material and testing out new material. So they wouldn't call you and say, oh, you're shit or whatever, or this is... So it's more like, you know, the middle ground where...
Yeah.
Will this stick? Will this not? Etc.
I think that with online classes, there is one opportunity because of the very structure that you have. Now, you know, I know that your classes, I haven't actually looked at all of the classes that you have, but you do synchronous classes where you're meeting at particular times and there's perhaps less room for it there because you're, in this case, your audience or rather your students have signed up because they want this stuff that you've promised them. I mean, you can also say, hey, we're going to do an experimental seminar. We're going to try out some new stuff here. I don't know how well this is going to work, but that's a whole different ball game. But when you have like an online platform, even if you're teaching face-to-face classes, but you have a course management system, if you wanted to try out in small quantities something new, you can like shoot a video or record, you know, a podcast or produce some other resources and put it in there as something supplemental and then say, hey, you know, take a look at this, see what you think, give me some feedback, be honest, is it good, does it suck, you know. But it would be something supplemental. And then if it is good, then you could say, okay, next time around, I incorporate this. But I will admit that I am when it comes to academic classes, I'm often just a couple steps ahead of the students. So, you know, for example, I've been lucky. Marquette University hired me back to teach this upper level core class required for juniors and seniors. And it's got this very long name that nobody actually really follows called Service of Faith and Promotion of Justice. And it's supposed to be some sort of problem-oriented thing. So some people will do like homelessness or debt or, you know, faith and reason. And I chose to pick anger because I do so much work on anger. And I, you know, so I needed like a textbook to anchor it. And so I took Martha Nussbaum's Anger and Forgiveness, which, you know, if I had to rate it, it'd get like a 3 out of 5 stars. It's not a great book, but it's not terrible. And it works for a classroom. And then I supplemented it with all sorts of other stuff. Sometimes I had, you know, resources on it. Sometimes I had to create them. So like, it was, you know, I'd read before Joseph Butler, who's got these great sermons about resentment and forgiveness, but I'd never actually produced any resources on it. So last fall, I recorded, I think, about eight video lectures on it and I was talking about it in class too, but these are supplemental for my students. And then, you know, there was quite a bit of other stuff like Lactantius on the anger of God or Aristotle's stuff in Rhetoric Book 2. And so I would just produce these resources and teach it to my students. And then I've got more stuff in the catalog that I can use. So it's sort of like a comedian testing out stuff or a band saying, hey, we're going to do this song, you know, that's not normally in our set list. Check it out. And I can get away with doing that. You know, whereas I think at some schools, maybe they wouldn't like you doing that. You know, They want you to kind of stick to what you're doing.
Yeah, and this is maybe the reason why also, like it's in your case, it's consistency and persistence, and you keep on just producing new content on YouTube. Like it's amazing, yeah. To be honest. Like you always renew yourself. Like you have lectures and series on a spectrum of philosophers, right, from ancient contemporary, yeah. Almost. So I think this also is one reason why you can avoid stagnation and continue to,
yeah,
to grow.
I'm interested in all sorts of things. Now there is a flip side problem to that, namely that you don't buckle down and specialize and just focus on this. Actually, there's two flip side problems. So the one is, you know, if you're spreading yourself wide, you're probably thinner than somebody who just does Aristotle and just does Aristotle's metaphysics, right? Or just sticks to the Stoics. The other problem that I've run into, and this might also be a problem for you because you've got, you know, fairly diverse interests, is people get to know you as the guy who does this and they don't realize that you do this other thing over there. So for example, the Half Hour Hegel Project, which is, you know, it's great. I'm almost done with it. I'll be happy when I'm finished. I think it's a useful resource for a lot of people. There's a ton of people out there who think that I'm just a Hegel guy, and then they'll see me doing something on Aristotle or the Stoics or Christian thinkers, and they'll be like, what is this? I can't believe that he's deviating from, you know, this thing over here. Same thing with, you know, the people who know me for the Stoicism stuff or St. Anselm stuff, or pick whatever else you want. And then they'll see things like me talking about heavy metal or speculative fiction. And sometimes they're almost like offended, you know, why are you going outside of your little box, you know? And other times they're cool with it, but they're like, well, he must be a dilettante, you know, because he's doing the Hegel thing over here. How could he possibly know anything about this topic over here?
Which is quite curious. Like it's something I don't think I experienced the same problem as you, because I made it clear outright that I am an entertainer. So, and I don't teach philosophy. I entertain. So
yeah.
Those who sign up for my courses know what they're signing up for. But in your case, you're actually the Hegel series or Stoicism or the series on anger, which we can come back to afterwards, because I used to be angry and then I decided to read philosophy.
I saw that. You got a sequence of tweets that are really good about that.
Yeah, but the latest one is kind of half, like they're always half kind of true and half just made up, you know, with a bridge.
Yeah, yeah. Thing.
But yes. So, and you like, is it a bad thing or a good thing? Like, do you consider yourself a specialist in a particular philosopher, school of thought? And is this how it should be, or is this a good thing? Bad? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I tell people I'm an eclectic, right? And then people automatically assume that you're just doing like a little bit of this and a little bit of this and a little bit of this. But I'm an eclectic in the way that Cicero, who I greatly admire, was an eclectic. He officially did tie himself to a particular school, the Plato's Academy, which by that time had taken a skeptical turn. But the way in which he understood that skeptical turn was, you could be like a hardcore skeptic and be like, hey, nobody knows anything. You put up an argument, I'll knock it down. Or you could be the kind of person who'd be probabilistic. You'd say, well, I think the Stoics probably have this stuff right. I'm not going to embrace their whole system. Like, you know, for example, he thought divination was nonsense and there's good arguments against it, even though the Stoics kind of like that. But when it came to the ethics, he was willing to take a lot of stuff from them. And then he would take other things from the academics. And he'd even, you know, on occasion say that the Epicureans had something right. So, and the Aristotelians too, he was a big fan of them. So I'm like that. But obviously in the present, we have way more choices than Cicero had. So I can, you know, I can say that I'm a specialist, but I'm not like at the top tier for any of the things that I specialize in. So I can talk meaningfully about Aristotle. There's certain texts that I wouldn't like try to present myself as an expert on, like Parts of Animals or the, you know, prior and posterior analytics. And there's definitely people who know way more than me about, you know, the rhetoric or the Nicomachean ethics or the politics. But, you know, I can do a pretty good job with it, certainly well enough to bring something interesting to the table. And similarly, there, you know, like when studying St. Anselm, who's the person I've actually published the most about, there's definitely St. Anselm scholars who are far better versed in his text than I am. But, you know, I'm not a slouch. I like to say this too about Stoicism. There's a lot of people out there who label themselves as Stoics. It's probably the biggest, you know, contemporary ancient philosophy, modern times movement. And a lot of them don't actually know much about Stoicism. It's like they just are happy to be on a team and they're beginners or at the beginner slash intermediate level. And I don't call myself a Stoic, but I probably know more about Stoicism and have incorporated more than the people who actually label themselves as Stoics when they really should call themselves like Stoics with training wheels or Stoic beginners. Now, you know, when it comes to like the experts in the field, do I know as much about any Hellenistic philosophy as Chris Gill does? No, he's like, you know, levels above me, you know, or Julia Annas or, you know, people like that. No, I'm kind of, you know, at an intermediary level, but you know, I guess one of the cool things about that is that's not nothing, right? So you don't have to be at the absolutely highest level to get a lot out of studying philosophy, you know?
And if you want to become a specialist in a particular school of thought, philosophy, or a philosopher's work, you'll have to really dedicate all your life to that. And you'll have
that's
to
read one of the problems.
Everything about or that has been published or will be published, or, you know, digging in the archives, and you just spend your life. It reminds me of Sartre's nausea.
Okay. You know, like, right, the Roquentin character, yeah.
And him, the Antoine Roquentin, yeah, exactly. So the guy, you know, spends his days at the archives trying to write a chronicle or a bio of this historical figure. And then he's like, what am I doing spending my time? Like, this, it's not that this is good or bad, but then is this something you're interested in?
You know, I never really thought about this, but that has to be based, if not on a particular real life person, at least like Sartre's experience of his contemporaries, just as much as the Age of Reason incorporates Sartre as, you know, this kind of.
Yeah.
And play fast and loose university professor.
Which is, again, like and Brian McGee says something about this. You're probably familiar with McGee. I don't know if you are.
Sort of, yeah.
Yeah, it's just he was like, yeah, scholars are really good, but this is not for me. I prefer, you know, being an eclectic, as you called it, and I'm more interested in his case in popularizing philosophy and just getting people engaged. And you kind of combine both. I'm assuming you have, so in the courses that you give, and afterwards I'll jump into Unamuno because I do want to talk about him a bit. In your courses, you mentioned at university you have like more a upper level course, but have you also taught like seminars and hardcore stuff that specialize in one particular philosopher? Because from what I see, you combine both kind of, right?
Yeah.
On the one hand, you're popularizing for those who are interested, and then you do the other bit.
Yeah, I mean, in academic positions, I've only rarely gotten to teach a course that's specifically on one thinker. And as a matter of fact, the only one that I've done recently is not on a philosopher, although I would say she's very philosophical. It's Ursula K. Le Guin's Earthsea novels and short stories. At Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design, I was able to teach. You have to propose your classes, and then they say yes or no. And so I proposed a class, which would be about all the six books of Earthsea. And it got approved, but that's more literature than straight out philosophy. In the past, when I was in my first teaching position, which was at Indiana State Prison in this extended education program that now no longer exists, unfortunately, I was expected to teach like the whole curriculum. Indiana.
Because I did I've come across this in one of your previous videos, but yeah, I'm more curious because you did talk about this.
So Ball State University was at one time one of the United States leaders in prison education. There were over 100 professors from Ball State, full-time professors, who are teaching in the prisons in Indiana. And it was always a bit unpopular with the taxpayers because, you know, they were like, why do these you know, criminals, why are we spending money on them? But, it you know, if you think about it economically, it's a great way to keep people out of prison, because when you earn a degree in prison, which is a lot of work, and it's much more difficult than doing it at a regular educational institution, the rates that we call them recidivism rates of people going back to prison after they're released, they go down just dramatically. They did a study at one time and they found that with no post-secondary education, it was about 66%. So 2 out of 3 guys who got out of the prison would go back to the prison within 5 years. With an associate's 2-year degree, it went down to 12%. And with a bachelor's, it went down to 6%. So from 66% down to 6%. And then they buried the study because they didn't want anyone to see it, because they want people to stay in prison. You know, that's job security. Whoa. But yeah. In any case,
that's my interesting nonetheless. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, that's just like the economic argument. And when you actually teach in prison and you see these prisoners learning things within their history and philosophy and literature classes, and then applying them to their life to change who they are, that's pretty amazing stuff. But the taxpayers were always like, screw these guys, you know. And so when the economic crisis hit in 2007 and 2008, they closed down the program, and then I had to find another job. But while I was there, I was one of two people who taught philosophy and religious studies classes, and the other guy who taught them taught at other prisons, and I only taught at that prison. So I would teach four or five or six classes per semester there with these guys. And, you know, we needed to cover everything you would need in order to do a major in philosophy. So I got to teach ancient and modern philosophy and contemporary philosophy, and do seminars sometimes, you know, like on existentialism, which was always very popular with them. And so it was quite good. And I don't get much opportunity to do that sort of stuff anymore, in part because I'm mostly teaching as an adjunct for institutions that are hiring me to teach, you know, like introduction to philosophy or ethics or things along those lines, which I love doing. But you don't get to specialize just in, we're only going to look at this author or this school of authors.
Yeah. And
but I can do that in my spare time, right?
Precisely. So you're either way, you're kind of doing it. And you mentioned existentialism, and
that's a good inroad to Uno Mono, right?
Exactly, because you one of the courses that is actually quite popular is existentialism. And incidentally, today I published an article about my 3 years journey, because I took the Twitter in May 2020.
Okay.
Tweeting, you know, I'm gonna. So I thought there was an economic crisis in Lebanon. My salary was peanuts. and I couldn't pay the rent anymore, so I needed to find something else to complement this. And then there was the pandemic, of course, and lockdown, etc. So I was like, let me try my luck. I'll post something on Twitter, see if people would be interested. And so I chose, because I thought it would be popular, existentialism and literature.
Okay.
And it was, again, a strike of luck, just like you said. 40 people ended up signing up. I did not have a page. I did not have a payment gateway. I did not have anything. So the first tweet I posted, somehow people got interested. So I was reflecting on this today. Like, it was almost three years ago. I published the tweet on May 11th. Today we're May 24. And in June, we started existentialism and literature. So it's usually popular because it relates to, like, existentialism as a movement focuses on human beings as a subject of flesh and bone, as Unamuno would say, right? But then usually when I say existentialism, or if not existentialism, if people are not familiar with the term, you say Sartre, Camus, and precursors of existentialism, Kierkegaard, Nietzsche, people have heard about these authors, right?
Right. Yeah.
But then you mention Miguel de Unamuno, and no one know who that guy is, at least now. He was very popular back in the day, and his dates are 1864-1936, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Why?
I would say there's a couple other people, too, in the existentialist, let's call them,
of course.
Umbrella that are like that, like Lev Shestov, who I think is, you know, he and Unamuno are kind of covering similar ground,
right? I don't know who that guy is.
Oh, he's really fun to read. If you like Unamuno, you will like him. He was a Russian guy from a Jewish family, fled after the revolution to Paris, where, you know, so many Russians went to. And he was, I call him a second generation, and I include Unamuno in that as well, existentialist, where they're starting to see the connections between, as you call them, precursors like Kierkegaard and Nietzsche and Dostoevsky and Tolstoy and these guys. And then they're doing their own cool thing. So I think there's quite a few people that
same dates, almost 1866, 1938.
I mean, they live different lives, of course, right? One comes from one end of the continent, the other comes from the other end of the continent. But there's kind of a shared, what would you call it? I don't even want to say culture. I would say a civilization comprised of many cultures that they can participate in. And so the same, like you were saying, you know, existentialism focuses on the human being existing in real life situations. That's another thing that makes it quite attractive, because you don't have to like only do it at Oxford or Paris or places like that. You know, you can do it here in Milwaukee or in Salamanca or pick wherever else you want to, right? But yeah, there's all these interesting figures who have kind of dropped out of, we could call it the mythology of existentialism. You know, think about Lou Andrea Salome too. You know, she's kind of an interesting bridge figure between Nietzsche and Rilke. And she also studied with Freud and writes some interesting things of her own, but hardly anybody ever talks about her anymore, you know?
Yeah.
So, but yeah, Unamuno, I was really fortunate in that when I was an undergraduate studying philosophy, and there weren't many people doing that where I was studying it, there was a guy from Spain.
Ooh.
And he was another student, right? And he was like, I think maybe a year ahead of me. His name was David, and I forget his last name, but typically Spanish, it was a hyphenated last name. And so he wouldn't shut up about the guy. I think out of national pride. So we're taking this contemporary philosophy class, and like every class session, he would be like, and Unamuno says, and so after a while, I was like, well, who's this Unamuno guy?
this is the annoying type of students in class, no? But it's curious that he wouldn't shut up about Unamuno. When is that?
So
Around,
this
do you
would have
remember?
been in the 90s, early 90s,
90s.
when I was
Interesting.
a undergraduate.
Yeah.
And I didn't, you know, at that time, I didn't actually read Unamuno, but I sort of tucked it in the back of my head. And then I saw other references to him, and I was like, I should probably read this guy. And so, you know, I got Tragic, oh, you can't actually see it because of the Zoom thing,
Yeah.
Tragic Sense of Life, and read that, and, you know, read a few other things. And then I was like, you know, I could actually teach this stuff in existentialism class, and the students would have, because the tendency is to teach existentialism. So you get like, here's the granddaddies, Kierkegaard, Dostoevsky, Nietzsche, right, on one end. And then, you know, maybe we'll talk a little bit about Heidegger, and we'll read a little bit of Rilke. And then we get the Frenchies. And the Frenchies are basically just Sartre, who kind of took over the title, Camus, as you mentioned, de Beauvoir, and then they typically leave out Gabriel Marcel or other existentialists who were a big deal at the time. And there's all this other stuff missing in the middle. And Unamuno is, he should be in the top rank in that missing stuff, because Tragic Sense of Life is such a great book, you know, and it's so relatable. I won't speak for you, but when I read it, or I read people like Shestov, I'm like, well, this guy's, you know, I don't agree with him on everything, but he's certainly got some interesting thoughts, and there's like real philosophical rigor here without losing the sense of like personal involvement and commitment. And I like the fact that he doesn't have to have everything neatly worked out. He's willing to leave some things and say, oh, this is as far as we got, you know, figure it out on your own at this point.
This is part of the criticism addressed
Yeah.
at Unamuno. It's like he doesn't have a philosophical system. So many people don't
Yeah.
even look at him as a philosopher because like what you're talking about is just maybe something like Nietzsche, right? Like some
Yeah,
analytic
yeah.
philosophers and others, they would look at Nietzsche as a literature guy. And
Yeah.
similarly for in the case of Unamuno, but for those listening to us and they don't know absolutely anything about Unamuno, I did teach Unamuno in one of my existentialism courses online. So it was,
Yeah.
if I remember correctly, it was who's the Romanian I think guy.
Oh, are you thinking about Chiron?
Yeah, Emil
Yeah.
Cioran, and I did not teach like Philippe, the co-teacher taught that, and we did Unamuno and Najib Mahfouz, and we did one more guy. I forgot. It was Philippe's. I think he did. We did this Dostoevsky, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
Yeah. But yeah. So how would you? So someone on the street knows absolutely nothing about Unamuno or his philosophy. How
Yeah.
would you hook them with what he has to say?
Well, you know, I think that phrase that you brought up before about it's philosophy for the human being who is of flesh and bone and blood. That's key. Unamuno, I mean, if he wants to, he can talk in very theoretical terms about what these people are doing at a kind of high level, but he's always coming back to the human being and what's really distinct about them. Their rationality is rooted in the actual human subject, who isn't just an individual, but exists in relation to others. And yeah, I mean, he talks about reason as being a social thing rather than being like this thing that we've got like tucked away in our head. And so you philosophize as a living, breathing person with the concerns that you have from the problems and vantage points and opportunities that you have right here, right now. I mean, if he were living today, he would be on the internet and talking about, and speculating about what it's doing to us. And he'd probably be shooting videos and have a podcast. You know? So I think maybe that's one appeal. But you could also highlight that absolutely key theme, tragic sense of life. Why is it tragic? Because we have to die. And we really do live nowadays, at least here in America, and I would say probably through much of the developed world, in a culture that tries to insulate us as much as possible from seeing death. You know, I mean, this is going to be like from way out field, but you could think about it analogous to like the four sights that the Buddha encounters before he's the Buddha. You know, he's got what we would nowadays call helicopter parents who have a lot of resources and they don't want him to be bothered by stuff, you know, so he doesn't get to see any old people or sick people or, you know, corpses or anything like that. And Unamuno says, no, we need to see that sort of thing. We need to think about that because we are going to die and we can't afford to have this kind of imaginary, oh, we're going to a better place sort of thing. We should actually like think about what it's going to be like when we're gone. Are we going to somewhere else or is this it? You know, and he realizes that within all of us, and this is another thing I really love about the work, there are these desires and demands on our part for what might not actually be the case. Like maybe there's a God, maybe there isn't, you know, but we sure as hell want there to be one, at least some, you know, image of it. And we sure do want to live on. And I think a lot of people can relate to that, you know?
Yeah, before I discuss this briefly,
yeah,
is there this tendency to kind of put death away or try, is it really, are we trying to do that? Is this how? Because I have come across this sometimes when I'm teaching, and then I find it kind of curious that people, I don't know if it's in the culture or if it's just people are trying to forget about death. And this is I don't know, the tragic sense of life in the sense that we are going to be dying. We
do have a lot of cultural depictions in the stuff that the ancient Greeks would have called poetry and we call film, television, podcast, drama, pick video games, right? But it's usually sanitized. You know, you can watch shows where dozens of people are dying, but it doesn't actually like linger over them. And, you know, you're seeing, as they say, the lights go out in somebody's eyes and an entire world being dissolved or destroyed, let alone what the effects are on their family, you know, and not just as they go to the funeral, but 6 months later, a year later, you know, the missing person. I mean, there are some cultural products, you know, some films, some television shows that do, in fact, do that well, but I would say 99% of them don't. If death is depicted, it's usually in the middle of conflict, right? And it's you know, the main characters, they don't die. They've got plot armor and everybody else is dying around them. Or, you know, somebody close to them is killed by the antagonist and then they have to go get revenge. But we don't get an awful lot of, like, let's call it real engagement with death.
It's always abstract, at least maybe unless someone close goes through, you know, a situation, circumstance, illness, and then they might pass away. Like there is no actual maybe war. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is because curiously, again, the first kind of course, a philosophy course ever I took was Existentialism and Literature, 2007.
Okay.
And I wrote an article about this because for me, the reason why I went into philosophy, there are two reasons why I went into philosophy after I finished my BS in business or BBA, whatever it's called. One, because of the financial crisis, no one understood what was going on. And so I was like, if you guys cannot give me the answers, what am I doing here? And this is true.
Yeah.
Like and the other reason is war. The living in Lebanon at particularly, yep. Like I'm aware of so many episodes of war, but the 2006 one was, I'm 16 years old or 15, I forgot, 16, I think 17. 2006, I was 17. Yeah. And you know, you're perceiving death. It's right around the corner and everything, you know, buildings are being bombarded. So it got me, this is where, yeah, the tragic sense of life is like death is there. My grandpa had died before when I was young, but it did not have the same effect, old age, etc. You know, it's not the same, but here you're living it, you're experiencing, you might die at any moment in time. My grandma's house, for example, was bombarded as well, razed to the ground. So it got me to think about philosophy and death, and this is why existentialism kind of resonated with me. In the case of Unamuno, it was in fact his son. Maybe this is the crisis that he had, reconciling reason and faith, because he wanted to believe in a god, but then you cannot really know whether or not there's a god. His son Raimundo, I think he was called, had an illness, and he passed away a year after he was born, maybe less, maybe more, I don't know. And this kind of got him to think about, in this sense, the tragic sense of life. And it's
yeah, curious. I would say one other thing too about, so it's a great title, and it does, he, you know, in the very introduction he says, I'm going to be talking about this tragic sense of life, and so you might think, oh, it's going to be a big downer, right? But it's not, you know, because there's also plenty of, we could say, comedy within it. Comedy in the old sense, where, you know, when Aristotle talks about tragedy and comedy, tragedy is about very high level people. You know, they've got great power and virtue, and they give these wonderful speeches. And then comedy is like you and me, ordinary people who, you know, have to figure, you know, sometimes when we often say everyone puts their pants on the same way, you know, one leg at a time. But comedy is when you're trying to put your foot through the pants and it gets stuck halfway through because you got big feet, and then you like trip a little bit, right? That happens to all of us. And it, maybe not pants, but something else. And I think there's a good bit of that in here as well. You could say it's a understanding of contingency. That and some of us are going to have children who die young. I hope I won't be, because I've got two kids myself. But you know, you have these contingent events that happen, and then you have to figure out what you're going to make of them. Are you going to, so let's say you do have somebody close to you die. When you're standing in the funeral line, and people come up to you and they say silly things like, oh, they're in heaven looking down at you now, you know, I'm sure they're in a better place. What do you do? You know, do you say, oh yes, I'm sure that's the case, and lie about it? Or actually, when my mother died, I'll tell you this story. It's a little bit long, but you may get a kick out of it. So when my mom died, she was a very, very vivacious person, made friends everywhere. And she happened to be the secretary of this club that she was in, which unfortunately had thousands of people. And so when she died and we were at the funeral, it's me and my, at that time, girlfriend, and my sister and her boyfriend, and a few, you know, like my grandfather and grandmother and a few other family members, and we're all dressed in black, typical sort of thing. And the funeral line, it took 6 hours for all of them to come through, because she had about 100 people from her work show up. And then my family was very large, so we had about 200 people from my family. And then there were at least 1,000 people from this club, you know, and they would, you know, they would say weird, wacky stuff like that. Like, oh, you know, she's got her wings. She's an angel now. And after a while, I got a little fed up, and I'd say, for all we know, she could be down in hell. You know, I mean, she didn't die reconciled with the church. Where are you getting all this silly nonsense from? And, you know, it's just as likely as the other. And, you know, there was sort of an absurdity to it, this need to, you know, put comforting labels on, you know, something that we can all relate to as human beings. I mean, we all are going to die. Everybody through history has died. It's not like we're special, or that the destination for our bodies or spirits is, you know, tailor-made for you and me and our generation. We're all in the same boat, you could say.
Yeah, now come to think about it. Yeah.
I think COVID kind of brought that home to the people who were willing to look at it starkly and not pretend that it wasn't a real disease, you know. It's kind of a shock to many.
And this is also maybe why existentialism and literature resonated 3 years ago. And,
yeah.
But now come to think about it, and we can maybe tie this to Unamuno. Maybe the reason why they share these comforting kind of words is not because they are directing them at you, but at themselves because of this longing for immortality Unamuno talks about.
Yeah, that would be putting the best sort of sense on it. That they've got the same desire that we all have, and it's just kind of misguided into these easy, superficial, available cultural concepts, you know?
Because Unamuno's struggle was also maybe something along the lines of, Socrates, I'm thinking now, Diotima, but this, like, okay, I'm going to die.
Yeah.
But I really, 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 really want to live. And the tragic sense of life and the sense that this is going to end. And so what do I do? Because I usually get these questions, right? And how would you, like, what would you say about this? How do I create value? Do I look for meaning? Do I write a book because this might make me immortal? How does maybe Unamuno, and what do you think about
it's, this? Like, it's interesting.
How should we approach this?
I mean, you brought up Diotima, so let's actually use the symposium and the several different levels that she talks about. So there's those who are pregnant in their body, and they go and look for somebody that they can have sex with and make little babies, and the babies are going to be their immortality. But kids never turn out the way that you expect, you know. I have two kids, neither of them are particularly interested in philosophy, and that's fine, because at their age, neither was I necessarily, you know. When I was a student, I was reading philosophy, but also partying a lot and, you know, doing other things too. So maybe they'll come back.
Doing philosophy in a different way.
Exactly. Yeah. You cannot count on your kids being little yous that are going to continue on whatever project your life is about. And if you try to make them that way, you just make them miserable and you make yourself miserable, you know? So what if we do think about, like, writing a great book? You know, Plato has Diotima talk about those who are pregnant in the soul, and they produce, you know, like Homer, and I forget who else. She might bring up Hesiod as these great poets who produce something cool. Okay, so maybe I write a book, or maybe you write a book. But, you know, there's no guarantee that people are actually going to be reading it 100 years from now and understanding it. I mean, to take Unamuno, it's great that his stuff is still in print and we can read it and be like, holy shit, this is really good stuff, right? But he could have easily have slipped through the cracks and just totally disappeared. So what about if we go to a higher level for Plato? Those who form institutions, those who set up the laws for things. Well, if you can actually get people to let you do that, that's great too. But when it comes to most of the features of our contemporary life, we don't think about the people who, you know, made the roads go the way that they go, or created our legal systems, or, I mean, we hear about some of them, a very limited few, but the viewpoint that we have on them is, you know, just a tiny little keyhole into who they were. And so none of these are really great ways to make yourself immortal. And you probably can't make yourself immortal in any lasting sense. The best you can do is to put your stuff out there and, you know, have tried to live a rich life that's engaged with other human beings, so you make their lives a bit more interesting or better or less screwed up, and then you're gone, you know. But that doesn't mean that it's meaningless or that it doesn't have any value, you know.
This is I think what some of the students struggle with. Like there is
I think you're right.
If this is nihilism, or if you're saying that okay, we cannot know whether there's a God or whether there's a reason where that would allow us to access some sort of truth, what are we left with? And I always have the same discussions, like, are we creating value? You know, you get the sense of, are we creating values? Are we discovering these values? How are we going to be living? What if I decide to go YOLO, but then I have like moral responsibility to others and so many things, right? This is what some students, or at least this is what students associate nihilism with. And I'm like, no, it's not that there's no values, then we can do whatever we want. It's just that they're acknowledging that there is no kind of a preset values that we have to follow. But this is why we're here, because we're here to kind of think about things and come up with, it's tricky, not our own values as such, or our values, knowing that we are social animals and we have moral responsibility to others.
Right.
Something
that's certainly part of it. And then you can say that you can, as an individual, also give your own experience its due. So, you know, going out, for example, you know, I'll take a walk later on today, probably down by the Menominee River, which is, you know, kind of a canal here in Milwaukee. And I'll look and see what's growing because it's springtime. And so I'll see the shoots coming up, and there'll be a few flowers, but not a lot of flowers. I really like flowers, you know, and I'll look at the stuff and I'll observe the seagulls landing and doing their thing. There's probably geese and ducks and things like that. And you could say, well, who gives a crap, right? That's all just a meaningless world full of these animals and plants that are doing purely mechanistic things. And you can say, yeah, but I can still appreciate it, you know? And it doesn't have to be like this grand scheme of things. And if somebody else wants to come along with me and appreciate it, even though they won't see exactly the same thing as I do, and maybe they're distracted a little bit, it's still worth doing. Or, you know, I can at least decide whether it's worth doing or not, and they can decide. And if I want to write a poem about it later, you know, I'm not a good poet, but I could do that, you know, and somebody gets something out of, you know, my observing the goose's wing or something like that, that's not nothing, right? It's just not, as you put it, this top level thing. And, you know, we can live a perfectly good existence that is full of all of these little interesting moments that we often share with other people. And then, you know, there's like, you know, some other things that you mentioned, our social nature. We have our responsibilities, you know, and living those out, that can be a fully meaningful life, even if everything else is screwed up around you. You know, as you mentioned, it being in Lebanon, Lebanon is always sort of like in a dually precarious situation, because you have the internal conflict that's seemingly never ended, right? And then you've got all the other neighboring countries around who are doing their own thing, which affect this tiny little island that, I mean, it's not a literal island, but it's kind of a culturally an island, Lebanon, right? So if Syria goes to crap, well, that's going to have effects on Lebanon. If Turkey starts to get antsy about what's going on in Syria, or, you know, about the Kurds, then that affects Lebanon too. You know, what is Iran going to do in terms of, you know, supporting or not supporting the Shia there? Well, you know, you're just stuck with it, right? But it doesn't mean that sitting with a friend and, you know, having a conversation becomes valueless because it could be taken away from you because of what other people do that you have zero control over, you know. And this is kind of where like stoicism and existentialism, they're not the same thing, but they do overlap to some degree, you know. And I like that Unamuno, you know, one of the people he brings up, Marcus Aurelius, you know.
Yeah, and this is actually, and we can end here. This is how Unamuno lived his life. He had this crisis.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And but despite all that, when he was in Salamanca, he always loved to go hiking and to visit new cities. So he traveled around quite a lot. Even when he was well, they exiled him at one point, but that's besides the fact. Philosophically speaking, like, he loved to go on hikes. He would go. He would frequent the cafes, Café Noelty, and the Plaza Mayor. And he would have discussions with his friends and with the professors. So he was like, the when I usually describe a philosopher, everyone's thinking, you know, behind the desk and and thinking all day. And then this guy was more of a theatrical person. As you said, he would have been on Twitter today and trolling everyone around and making claims about so many things just because that's how
just to provoke
provoking people and but educating at the same time, which is quite interesting. And he got in trouble because of that. We don't know whether or not he was assassinated or he died of natural causes, but yeah, eventually this is what you have, kind of. You just, as you said, try as much as possible to appreciate life and focus on what you can control. And this is where Stoicism would come in. And if you ever are angry, try reading philosophy. But then, I don't know, you start reading Hegel and you're like, fuck this shit, I'm out of here. And you become angrier.
I'll tell you a funny story. So I, you know, when I was an undergraduate, one of my professors was actually a German guy who had lived through the Second World War as a kid. And then he got the hell out of there as quick as he could to the United States. And he hated Hegel. And he would say that whenever he needed to get to sleep and he couldn't fall asleep, he would get Hegel's Logic off of his nightstand and just start reading it. And within a page, he would immediately fall asleep because that's just so abstract and boring, you know?
Yeah, which is kind of, I mean, your series is, I think you're at the Phenomenology of Spirit. Are you doing
that? That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is equally, I don't know.
Abstract. Boring. Yes.
And abstract. But yes, it's very difficult to read. So yeah, you're doing a great job with Hegel. Good on you. But I don't know. Like, I would listen, I would watch your videos, but I don't think I will ever read Hegel ever again. It's just too tough.
You know, I'll tell you something that's sort of like peeling the curtain back that maybe some of your listeners or viewers might get a kick out of, and I think it could also be encouraging. So when I'm going to produce a half hour Hegel video, I'm reading through the entire section and then reading the particular paragraph or paragraphs that I'm going to work on. And I've got my chalkboard and I'll like diagram some stuff out that I'll use in part to guide my own thinking, but also so that there's something visual. And some days I can do it and other days I can't. After putting in all that work, I can have the lights on and the camera and have like my lapel mic and I've got everything on the chalkboard and I've just reread the paragraph, and I'll get there and I'll be like, oh, I don't know what I want to say. I lost the train of thought. And that happens more often with Hegel than say with Marcus Aurelius, who's easier, you know, or Unamuno. But it has happened with other philosophers. So what people often see are our successes, the products that made it, right? They don't see all of the starting off, getting a minute into it and being like, oh, I got to do another take, or just walking away from it altogether. And so, you know, it's similar with books. We read these authors' books and we're like, holy shit, these people are smart, you know, way smarter than I am. We don't see the nights where they like threw away 50 pages and they're like, this is garbage, you know, and maybe threw away some good stuff. So I think it's good to keep in mind that what we do get to see with these interesting cultural products are just the just a facade, just the good stuff.
Yeah, and the article I wrote was called In Praise of the Process, because that's what often goes missing. It's like, you said, you go through so many things and of course you're improving. Like the first time I gave a course ever in 2013, February, I was shit. I might be less shitty now, but then I improved, right? Like maybe I'm not that good, but it's like there's this process, and as you said, like sometimes you try to explain something, and like one day you explain Hegel phenomenally, and then the other day you just don't know what to say. So I feel you.
I'm lucky that I didn't begin recording my lectures at the beginning of my teaching career, but rather that would have been like 12 or 13 years in, because when I first started teaching, I was terrible.
This is why I almost, I still don't feel ready to post my, like to record lectures separately and just share them. Right. I do have sample lectures. I don't mind sharing my lectures, but then I wouldn't present my async courses or lectures as I am doing a good thing here, because I still feel like I'm only 10 years in. So I still feel like I can do a lot of improvement.
You know what I will say about that though? You don't have to be great. You just have to be good enough. And the good enough there is not measured by any sort of objective standard. It's measured by whether your students are, after the lecture is over, whether they are better equipped to read whoever it is that you're talking about.
Yeah. You know? That's a good advice. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Where can people find you?
Well, I'm really fortunate in that at this point in time, all you got to do is put into Google Gregory Sadler and all sorts of things are going to come up. So they can find my YouTube channel that way. If they want to find my Study with Sadler Academy, just put that into Google and that pops up as well. And it works out quite nicely for me. As I've mentioned in telling other people about this, it really sucks for anybody else who's named Gregory or Greg Sadler, because first they can't get any traction anymore.
Philosophy and But thank you very much for this. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Yeah, we'll have to do this again sometime.
Definitely. And this was fun. Next time it would be about someone else or some other anecdotes, more maybe.
Sure.
The prison experience I'm curious about. But thank you very much, and thank you everyone for listening.